Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It's always great to join you at the end of the week to play the game of catch-up, see what's going on in this wacky world of ours, and it just keeps on getting wackier. For those of you new to the program, I'm a retired senior special agent with the old INS, 30 years with that agency, and in the wake of 9/11, as you know, I have taken my show on the road to try to wake up our fellow Americans and our leaders, if only they're willing to listen, to the perils of open borders and to the perils of an electorate that increasingly is not getting the necessary information from the mainstream media. I want to start out by reminding you about two of my favorite websites, my own personal website, michaelcutler.net, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, Michael Cutler, one word, .net. Also, I'm a senior fellow with a terrific organization in California, known as Californians for Population Stabilization, located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. Great place to be, great place to visit, good friends, good workers out there. And they have been dedicated for years to the mission of waking Americans up to the need to properly enforce the immigration laws, secure our borders, and make certain that Americans are truly served by their own government. But, you know, well, by the way, their website, I almost left that out, is CAPSWeb, C-A-P-S, CAPSWeb.org. And I have an interesting article on that website that we will get to later on this evening. But let me start out by telling you that for right now, for the next half hour, we're going to be talking about something that I don't usually delve into, and that's the issue of global warming. And it also dovetails nicely with the way that it's increasingly difficult to get honest, objective information from the news media. We've heard so much about global warming, but there's been some events in the news that we will talk about shortly that I think are eye-openers. And so I decided today that I would bring on the program a gentleman by the name of Bonner Cohen, has a Ph.D. He's a senior fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research, great organization. They have been kind enough to provide me with a number of terrific guests. I had the opportunity to speak with Bonner a little while ago in preparation for this evening's program, and we are going to dissect, if you will, take a good hard look at this issue of global warming. And I want to start out by saying to you that I've been making the point for quite some time that while the schools teach us how to take exams and answer questions, I can't remember of any classes that I took in college or high school or anywhere that taught us how to ask the appropriate questions. And therein, as the saying goes, lies the rub. Maybe we'll get to some of those questions today. Bonner, are you there? Happy Friday. Thank you for joining me.
I certainly am, and I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you so much. Let's jump both feet into this messy puddle, if you will. Global warming, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that, first of all, global warming has been, as a term, has been superseded by climate change. And the change took place, in terminology, took place because the warming of the planet, which was so confidently predicted by the advocates of global warming, didn't take place. And so it became necessary to change the terminology from global warming to climate change. Therefore, if you have a severe snowstorm or something that's a little out of the ordinary, then you can attribute that to climate change rather than global warming. Now, the term climate change is interesting in its own right because it's redundant. Climates always change, they always have, and they always will. Why? Well, because climate is part of nature. Nature is inherently unstable. It is random. What you see today is not necessarily what you're going to see tomorrow. Every river in the world has a different course than what it had when I began speaking only a couple of minutes ago. The temperatures rise, temperatures fall. They have been doing that ever since the world came into being some 4.5 billion years ago. The issue at hand today is whether or not human activities, specifically the burning of fossil fuels, are causing, not contributing to, but causing global warming. I think the evidence is overwhelming that there no one has been able to show a cause and effect relationship between man-made emissions of greenhouse gases and a warming of the planet.
That's interesting. You know, we keep seeing the same thing, and it's right out of the pages of George Orwell. It is, to coin a phrase, Orwellian, this use of artful language to create an illusion that doesn't exist. You know, we spoke about it off the air earlier. With immigration, they've tried to strike the word alien from the conversation because the word provides clarity to the debate. Certainly, if you're doing something that's not justified by facts or statistics or common sense or the law, what you're left with is a way of making propaganda work for you. So it's about controlling the language of the discussion. I guess what you're saying is it's not much different here.
Yes, and one of the favorite terms that alarmists, and let's be clear as to who we're talking about here. These are environmental groups, extremely well-funded, most of them, academics, people who have a vested interest in continuing to receive government grants that are given to them by virtue of the virtual certainty that the research they carry out will produce the desired result. One of the favorite terms these people like to use is consensus. There is a consensus among the scientific community that, or there is a scientific consensus that the world is warming and it is being caused by man-made emissions of greenhouse gases or other human activities. Well, the assumption here is, of course, that science runs on consensus. Well, it most certainly does not. Science operates on evidence. Evidence which can always be updated in light of new discoveries which invariably come along. There is no consensus. The reason that the term consensus is used so often is that if you can get the public at large and the mainstream media, and getting the mainstream media to go along with this is actually pretty easy, but if you can get substantial segments of the public to believe that there is a consensus, then if there is a consensus, why have a debate? And if there is a consensus, let's then move to the quote-unquote solution. The consensus is being used here to stifle any and all debate. It is rhetorical tool which has no basis in science whatsoever.
Well, you know, I noticed the president tends to do this. He'll stand up, take a controversial issue, whether it's immigration, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be immigration. It could be anything. But he loves to use this approach of saying, everybody agrees.
Right, exactly.
And I'd like to know who the everybody is. Everybody knows. Everybody says.
That's right. But we're never told.
I'm sure you've heard it. And, you know, you sit there saying, well, who's everybody? Does this include the folks who are on the Bowery and drunk out of their minds and don't even know where they are? Who's the everybody? Are these experts? Are they, if it's a law enforcement issue, is it law enforcement? Everybody knows this is the case. And when I hear that nonsense of everybody, I run for cover. And there's another point. We don't even know, and I think you'll agree with me, and I hope our listeners understand the point, we don't even know all the components that make up climate. In other words, all the forces that influence it. They just found out recently, and I've been an astronomy nut going back to second grade, well, astronomers now believe that the sun is a variable star. What a variable star is a star that doesn't always crank out the same amount of energy. It's kind of like an engine, and when you step on the gas, the engine revs higher and burns more fuel and puts out more power. When you take your foot off the gas, well, imagine a star. No one's stepping on the gas, but the processes have the same effect. So if you turn up your three-way bulb and you're using 150 watts instead of 100 watts, the bulb gets hotter. If the sun cranks out more energy, doesn't it stand to reason that that would make the Earth warmer or cooler, depending on what the sun's doing cyclically? Does that make sense?
That's exactly right. And if you listen to the participants in the debate on global warming, you will occasionally hear people, even alarmists, referring to natural variability. Well,
right.
What constitutes natural variability? And that's the point you just addressed. There are certain things we know, or at least we think we know, and variations in solar radiation, sun intensity, all that, that's one of them. But how much of a factor that is something we don't know. We also know that undersea currents change or oscillate, and that the amount of heat or coolness that they bring to certain areas of the world changes from time to time. We don't know what causes that. We also know that undersea vents put a substantial amount of heat into the deep waters of the ocean, but that also varies. We also suspect, but don't know, that there's a fascinating interplay between the Earth's geological activity, which has been going on ever since the world was created, and the sun, an area that has not received as much attention as it should have. All of this, plus a whole bunch of things that we really don't know about, or he says, contribute to natural variability. Can you quantify natural variability? Answer, no. You can't quantify something that you don't have a clarity over as to what really constitutes.
In other words, what you're saying is we don't know what we don't know.
That's right. We don't know.
How's that
for
putting it
precisely? We think
we
know what we know, and we certainly don't know what we don't know. Right. And
so
the
now, here's this thing that really sparked me and got my motor running. Last night, I've signed up for email alerts from the various news organizations. So New York Times last night puts out this thing, breaking news alert, Obama to announce carbon limits on power companies. And talking about the greenhouse gases and all this other business. And so I said, you know, I wonder what they're basing all this on. And I came across an article that was published yesterday on the Huffington Post. And the title is IPCC Climate Report Struggles with Temperature Quirks. Pardon me. You know immediately that that's interesting, temperature quirks. And it's a Stockholm report, and it's also by, I think Reuters may have contributed, but I could be wrong on that. But in any event, scientists working on a landmark UN report on climate change are struggling over how to address a wrinkle, I like that, a quirk, and now we have a wrinkle in the meteorological data that has given ammunition to global warming skeptics. The heating of Earth's surface appears to have slowed in the past 15 years, even though greenhouse gas emissions keep rising. And it goes on and says, for years, skeptics have touted what looks like a slowdown in the surface warming since 1998 to cast doubt on the scientific, there's your word, consensus that humans are cooking the planet by burning coal, oil, and natural gas. Scientists and statisticians have dismissed the purported slowdown as a statistical mirage, arguing, among other things, that it reflects random climate fluctuations and an unusually hot year picked as the starting point for charting temperatures. They also say that the data suggests the missing, in parentheses, missing heat is simply settling temporarily in the ocean. And they go on and talk about it. But now here's what's amazing to me. Leaked documents obtained by the Associated Press show that there are deep concerns among governments over how to address the purported slowdown ahead of next week's meeting of the IPCC. Quote, I think to not address it would be a problem because then you basically have the denialists, I guess that might be us, saying,
right.
Look, the IPCC is silent on the issue, said Alden Meyer of the Washington-based advocacy group Union of Concerned Scientists. In a leaked June draft of the report's summary for policymakers, the IPCC said that while the rate of warming between 1998 and 2012 was about half the average since 1951, the globe is still heating up. As for the apparent slowdown, it cited natural variability in climate systems as well as the cooling effect from volcanic eruptions and a downward phase in solar activity. So here's what they come up with. Here's three countries and what they want to do with the report. And this is what drove me crazy. I was originally a science major. Facts are facts. You know, you can't screw with Mother Nature. Well, but Germany said, oh, here it is. Germany called for the reference to the slowdown to be deleted. Just delete it. Leave it out.
Yeah. Right.
Saying that a time span of 10 to 15 years was misleading in the context of climate change. Well, what else do we leave out? What do we put in? So let's just leave out the facts because that contradicts whatever. The U.S. also urged the authors to include the leading hypothesis, in parentheses, that the reduction in warming is linked to more heat being transferred to the deep ocean. Do they know this for a fact? No, but that's an assertion that they're making. Now, this one's really great. Belgium objected to using 1998 as the starting point for any statistics. That year was exceptionally warm, so any graphs showing global temperatures starting with 1998 look flat. Using 1999 or 2000 as a starting year would yield a more upward-pointing curve, and in fact, every year after 2000 has been warmer than the year 2000. Hungary worried that the report would provide ammunition for the skeptics. So here we have all the leaders of all these countries that have invested lots of resources and money and expecting a return on the deal, saying, you know what, maybe we're going the wrong way down a one-way street, so let's make everybody look at the floor of the car so they won't see where we're headed. How's that for an analogy? Let's blindfold the passengers who are along for the ride so they won't notice we're going the wrong way.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what the article contained, the statement from Germany is particularly interesting because the Germans actually have it right in a sense, not in their saying it should be deleted, but saying that a time span of 10 to 15 years was misleading in the context of climate change, which is measured over decades and centuries. Well, and that, of course, they're absolutely right, but that undermines their whole argument. Because their whole argument was based on the assumption that there has been a warming caused by man-made greenhouse gases entering the atmosphere since 1940. Well, in geological terms, and that the most recent warming began in 1988. Well, from 1988 to 2013 is 25 years. 10, 15, 20, 25 years in geological terms is absolutely nothing. It's a blink of an eye, if that. So if you are going to make public policy decisions based on a warming, or for that matter, a cooling that took place, and what you're talking about here are tenths of a degrees in Fahrenheit, all you're talking about, either up or down. But you are going to make public policy decisions that will affect the lives of every man, woman, child in the United States, Germany, France, Britain, China, wherever. If you're going to make that on the basis of a temperature rise, of a minuscule temperature rise in a geologically tiny, minute period of time, this is absolute folly. And you can also see in the statements from the aforementioned countries how desperate they are to sweep anything under the rug that runs counter to the underlying assumptions of their whole approach. What these people are really interested in is the power that would come into their hands as a result of the regulatory scheme that they would put in place to control our use of energy. That's what this is all about. In my view, it has absolutely nothing to do with the climate. It never
will. There's two points, pardon me. Number one, has anybody measured the impact on global warming of all the hot air that's coming out of these leaders' mouths?
those are CO2 emissions.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
And let's not forget the cows who suffer flatulence, which is a far greater source. The other part of it, though, is what would this do to the economy at a time when we can't seem to get the economy running? You know, they're trying to jumpstart the economy. We've all had old cars when we were kids in particular, and the darn car would kind of start, and it would rattle and shake, and you thought you were going for a ride, and it would stall, and you'd have to try to restart it. That's kind of where the economy is. What would taking coal offline or taking petroleum? Now, look, I agree we need to wean ourselves off of Middle East oil. I'm a big proponent. I think it's about national security.
Yeah, we all agree with that. Yep.
And I think we've got to clean our environment. I think we're fouling our own nest. We're pouring tons of hydrocarbons into the air. I worry about cancer rates and autism and all kinds of ailments we suffer because there is a lot of pollution. And I'm all about clean air. I've got no problem with it. But shouldn't there be a semblance of logic and science behind decisions that are made that have this sort of a global impact? I mean, if you don't know what in the world you're doing, and then you're dealing with unintended consequences, you know, we have to use mercury light bulbs, fluorescent bulbs, because they burn less energy. Well, okay, they consume less energy, but when those bulbs make their way to the landfill and mercury starts leaching into the soil, well, what happens then?
In the name of energy economy.
Is that not a reasonable consideration?
It's a very reasonable consideration because ultimately we're talking about regulating our use of energy because the villain in all of this has been identified as fossil fuels, which account for roughly 85% of the world's, and as for that matter, for the United States, sources of energy. If you reduce the role of fossil fuels, starting with coal, and believe me, it won't stop there. After that comes natural gas. Coal is for these people simply a low-hanging fruit. So anybody in the natural gas industry who's high-fiving it and doing somersaults on the sideline and dancing in the end zone, hey, you're next, buddy, because they're not going to stop
coal. Your joy will be short-lived.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What this will do, it will lower the disposable income of, we'll keep this in the United States, lower the disposable income of every American, which is precisely what it is designed to do. What did Obama say when he was running for president in 2008? Under my global warming scheme, I'm paraphrasing here, the cost of electricity will necessarily skyrocket. If the cost of electricity necessarily skyrockets as a result of the regulatory decisions that the Obama administration is undertaking, who will be the ones to pay the biggest price for this? Well, they will be those who can least afford it. It's not going to hurt Matt Damon. It's not going to hurt Leonardo DiCaprio. It's not going to hurt Barbra Streisand. It's not going to hurt Bill Gates. But it is going to hurt people living off Social Security. The working families that we hear so much about, the middle class, which is supposed to be helped, which is actually going to be hurt by this. And so what you really have here is a scheme to make energy not affordable, but rather expensive, so that you essentially put government bureaucrats at the Environmental Protection Agency in the business of rationing energy, centralizing decision-making authority in Washington.
Well, you know what's interesting? Alan Greenspan testified for Chuck Schumer, and Schumer at the time is chairman of the Senate Immigration Subcommittee. And, you know, I've done a bunch of congressional hearings on these issues. And one day I was listening to Greenspan, I was doing a little bit of surfing, and said, oh, they're going to do a hearing, I'm going to go watch the hearing. Well, Greenspan gets up there, and I've got to tell you, Bonner, this absolutely blew me away, because I couldn't believe what I was hearing, and I couldn't believe that the media never covered it. The topic of the hearing was comprehensive immigration reform in 2009, this was 4 years ago, can we do it, and how? Afterwards, I wrote a commentary where I said it reminded me of the apocryphal law firm, Do We Cheat Them and How? But in any event, if I lose my sense of humor, my mind can't be far behind. But in any event, here was what he talked about. The need to bring in many more foreign workers, illegals to be a flexible workforce at the bottom rung. And then he talked about bringing in the high-tech, highly skilled workers with their families so they could occupy what he referred to as vacant housing units. Yes, people's homes that were lost to foreclosure become housing units. It sounds like a jail cell.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to my housing unit, forgive me, I'll see you tomorrow. I mean, crazy, housing units. And so here's what he said. First, skilled workers and their families, these skilled workers are foreign workers that he's talking about, they will of necessity move into vacant housing units, the current glut of which is depressing prices of the American homes, and of course house price declines are a major factor in mortgage foreclosures, and the plunge in value of the vast quantity of U.S. mortgage-backed securities that has contributed substantially to the disabling of our banking system. Now, think about that. He's talking about making houses worth more money, But then in his very next paragraph, he talks about how we've made a privileged elite out of Americans with skills. I'm going to read the paragraph. But what this would really mean is American families are never going to be living in the houses they lost to foreclosure, because they will become the houses of the new breed of worker, the foreign workers that we're seeking to import. You know, when we're told, and you're very well educated, you hold a PhD, it's remarkable. We're told, well, if we don't allow the foreign students who get the advanced degrees to stay in the United States and they leave, we lose the benefit of their education. And I've had reporters say to me, well, do you agree with that? I said, well, I have a better solution. Why aren't we educating American kids so when they go home, instead of going back to their country, they go back to their apartment inside the United States? But, I mean, God forbid we should do something that makes sense that helps Americans. But this was the paragraph that absolutely lit my fuse. Catch this. Greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums of skilled over lesser skilled. Skill shortages in America exist because we are shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism. In the process, we have created a privileged elite whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would reduce at least some of our income inequality. And, you know, it's remarkable, because when you think of income inequality, you're thinking about minority members. You're thinking about people being discriminated against by gender, by age. And that's wrong. You know, a day's work is a day's work, no matter who does it. But to talk about income inequality based on skill really is talking about the destruction of the middle class.
Yes, and we're seeing the destruction of the middle class. Something that's really been going on for decades and decades. The way the tax structure is constructed now, just sending a child to college now cost an absolute fortune. Look at the rate of inflation that has afflicted higher education, say, over the last 40 years, and look at the rate of inflation elsewhere. You will find that even though we fudge the real rate of inflation in this country, the rate of inflation for college tuition has soared, meaning that for most middle-class families, the only way your son or your daughter can go to a college, unlike the case 30, 40 years ago, right, is to take out humongous loans, which will have to be paid back upon getting your degree, assuming that you do. You're going to find out it's much more difficult to get a job now. You're either going to be unemployed or underemployed, but you still owe tens of thousands of dollars in student loans, which you paid at a grotesquely inflated for a grotesquely inflated tuition to keep the whole academic ripoff going, where you have to pay the salaries of bloated bureaucracies throughout the university systems, administrators who have assistant administrators, who have assistant administrators. In many colleges and universities today, you have far more people in administration than you have actually teaching. Well, these people have to be paid. Well, who pays for it? Well, the tuition. Well, as long as these administrators know that the government grants and loans are available, they don't care about raising the cost of tuition because somebody else is going to pick up the tab. So they have no incentive whatsoever to limit the cost of the quote unquote education they're giving. It's a gigantic scam. It's going to collapse at some point simply because it's unsustainable. But what they're doing is they're gradually pricing themselves out of the market. Meanwhile, we have young people in this country, recent college graduates, who owe $1 trillion, that's $1 trillion with a T, in student loans, and many of them are not going to be able to pay back. So we've created another bubble.
And by the way, you know, if your person declares bankruptcy, they can get out of the car loan. They may have to give up their car. They can get out of their mortgage payment. There's lots of stuff they can get out of. Student loans, you can go bankrupt, you're still going to owe that student loan. That doesn't go away.
You're still going to owe. That's right.
It's almost like that song about 16 tons, you know, the guy working in the coal mine.
Tennessee 94.
You know, where he said, I owe my soul to the company store. Here, you're going to owe your soul to the loans that the government gave you.
That's exactly right. Yep. Mm-hmm. And try to pay back those loans when you don't have a job.
I mean, this is such a prescription for a disaster. What's remarkable is that most people still don't seem to get it.
Yeah, that's right.
And they still continue to reelect the same knuckleheads into Congress that are doing it to them.
That's right, because it's a disease, if you will, that inflicts the entire political class in this country. You can find them. You can find them in both parties, and you can find them in our ruling elite that we have in Washington D.C., where I'm speaking from. And the system is rigged to benefit those in power. And if you are not in power, you're going to find yourself on the receiving end of this city's wisdom. And you're going to find out that it's really not all that smart. And we have allowed enormous amounts of power to be devolved to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats throughout Washington, D.C., and you will also see these people in state governments and in local governments throughout the country. Arrogant little, goose-stepping wannabes, but who, in fact, have real power over the daily lives of the people under their jurisdiction.
Well, you know, one of the problems that you have is that, you know, I've had long-term dealings with Washington. I'm in an interesting position because I was an agent for 30 years, but starting in the early 80s, I began working with members of Congress as a civilian. My agency didn't even know. I worked with Senator D'Amato back in the early 80s. He was the New York senior senator, to convince him to bring to life a piece of legislation that would call for a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison for criminal aliens who get deported, which now the result of that is that immigration criminal prosecutions lead the violations of laws that are prosecuted by U.S. attorneys across the country. It was a good piece of legislation. I'm very proud of it. But it got me started with dealing with the folks in Washington. People think, well, I've elected Joe Blow to be my congressman. What they don't know is that some 26-year-old kid recently graduated from Princeton, Yale, Harvard, Dartmouth, wherever, is actually the gatekeeper who controls not only your access to that politician, but his or her access to information. So you could do the world's best presentation for some 26-year-old kid on the Hill, but if they take this big, fancy, glossy report with charts and figures and everything and throw it into the circular file, that member of Congress doesn't even know that there was a report. That's right.
That's right. Yep.
So it's not even always that the member of Congress is the enemy. It's the system that has become the enemy of the average American.
That's right. And remember, many of the 26-year-olds you're talking about are simply biding their time here. What they want to do is come to the attention of a lobbyist in Washington,
where they can triple and quadruple their income.
Where they can triple the salary, which means you don't really rock the boat. You become a reliable source of information. You don't really do your boss's bidding as much as you do the bidding of those who can offer you a very lucrative position on K Street here in Washington. There is a street here in Washington called K Street, and that's where the glossy, very fancy palaces are located, where lobbyists can earn obscene amounts of money gaming the system here for their clients, who must make their way through the morass of the administrative regulatory state. Well, who better to hire to do that than congressional staffers who know how the game is played? So,
and who can pick up the phone and get people on the phone that they need to talk to.
That's exactly right.
When Alexander Haig, who had been the Secretary of State, stepped down, he went to work for one of the military contractors and was paid a cool $1 million a year. And this was about 30 years ago.
Oh, that's
right. And you would think,
yep,
well, why was Alexander Haig worth over $1 million? Access.
Access.
That's
oh, yes.
the name of the game. And by the way, I think it's not as benign as you portray it, where they're not going to rock the boat. I think that they know in advance that a particular industry that they're trying to work for as a lobbyist would be very upset if certain legislation was enacted that would have an adverse impact on their future employer.
Of course they do, and that's why they're
and
quite
so they
willing.
Become the censor. They become the gatekeeper and the censor.
They do, exactly.
And I've had situations with a couple of members of Congress where they voted for certain legislation or publicly came out in favor of certain legislation, and then when I had a one-to-one meeting, said, why in the world are you doing this? And the person said to me, what are you talking about? And I told him, and the look on the guy's face was one of rage. And within a week, this individual reversed his position, and you've got to wonder why he didn't understand it in the first place. Go back
right.
to the folks who work for him.
Right. That's exactly right.
So we've got members of Congress who don't read the bills. You have Nancy Pelosi, as we say in Brooklyn, who has the chutzpah to say, you won't know what's in the health care bill till you vote for it. So let me ask you something, Bonner. Would you buy a car or a refrigerator that was concealed by a tarp and you're told, well, when we deliver it, you'll find out what color it is, how many doors it has, and what it's going to cost you?
Well, no.
That's how they sold us health care.
That's exactly right. To a certain extent, it looks as if it's coming back to bite them, but that story has yet to play itself out, and it will probably play itself out over years to come. But it is symbolic, I think, for the level of ineptitude, the level of corruption in Washington. When I talk, I often refer to Washington as one of the most corrupt cities in the world. But when I say corruption, I'm not talking about laws being broken, bribes being taken, kickbacks, all that sort of thing. That happens, but frankly, that's the exception and not the rule.
Yep.
The corruption in Washington, which is widespread, endemic, and institutionalized, is how those laws come into being in the first place.
Yep.
Who benefits from them? Who is screwed by them? Which bureaucracies have vested interest in expanding their regulatory writ? And it is a gigantic behemoth that lives off the wealth of the rest of the country. I personally live in Arlington, Virginia, which is right across the river from Washington, D.C., and this place is booming. There are office buildings, condo buildings, all this going up. The wealth here is completely phony. It is money extracted from hardworking people throughout the United States, brought here to Washington to feed government contractors, government bureaucrats, and the lobbyists and what have you, all of whom feed off the giant Washington cookie monster, and many of whom make extremely good livings in doing so.
Well, I came up with something. I read this a couple of weeks ago. Maybe I'll dust it off and read it again. I hope you like this. It's the similarities between the two oldest professions, prostitution and politics, of course. Both professions begin with the letter P. Both professions involve lots of people getting screwed. In both professions, the practitioners will assume any position, no matter how ridiculous, uncomfortable, or contrary to common sense, for the right price. In prostitution, the clientele bring their fantasies that the prostitute tries to fulfill. In politics, the constituents bring their concerns, and the politicians respond by making promises that they fulfill by creating fantasies. STDs can give the clients of prostitutes a case of buyer's remorse, or perhaps a case of something else, while voters may well suffer buyer's remorse when they come to find out what their elected official does once he or she is sworn into office. Talk about the gift that keeps on giving. How does that work for you, Bonner?
It works for me very well. And sadly, that's funny, and it's also sadly very true. I think you think it's very important for our listeners to understand the depth of corruption that's here, and that the system here, which manifests itself in the healthcare law that you mentioned earlier, the preposterous regulations that are handed down by government bureaucrats, the vast majority of whom have no real experience in the real world. The decisions that are made that affects the livelihoods of every family in this country.
And national security.
And national security
and community safety.
That's right. Yeah, you name it, it's there. And based on science, which is, you know, at best rises to the level of witchcraft. And this is the kind of system we're stuck with now.
Well, and you know, and you watch how campaign finance, really, you get the best government money can buy. And I know my friends who are big proponents of the First Amendment, as I am, disagree with me, because I would love to see a law passed that says, if you give money to a politician running for a particular office, you may not also contribute money to his opponent. Because if you're doing that, you're not, pardon me, you're not supporting a candidacy, you're supporting yourself.
Oh, of course. And by the way, that practice is very widespread here.
Yep.
Where lobbying firms will contribute to both candidates. If Joe Schmo wins, they're in good graces with Joe Schmo.
Heads I win, tails you lose. That's the way it works.
That's exactly right.
I mean, this is absolutely astonishing. And look, I'm going to tell you what. I'm not certain that we don't have climate change. And yes, maybe. And you put it very well. You know, maybe we're contributing. The question is, how much are you contributing? You know, the cost of white wall tires on a Rolls Royce increases the price of the car. But compared to the overall cost of the Rolls-Royce, it's negligible. You know, so even if there is some change, to what extent is the question that nobody asks. So here's the interesting end of that article, that they made a point that really interesting here. Let me see if I can find this point. Okay. The IPCC draft report says that it is extremely likely that human influence caused more than half of the warming observed since 1950s, an upgrade from very likely. Based on what? So even here, we're shading the words extremely likely, very likely, sort of likely, maybe likely.
Another favorite one is the data suggest. Oh,
yep.
Suggests. Okay, yeah. Let's give our listeners a little bit of context here.
Sure.
We're talking about climate change. Over the past 2 million years, there have been 17 ice ages, which means that on 17 different occasions, the climate, for reasons we do not fully understand, cooled to such an extent that gigantic glaciers formed at the North Pole made their way south. Depending upon how intense a particular ice age was, some of those glaciers made their way as far south as Kentucky.
Yep.
New York City, where I think you grew up, in the last ice age was completely covered by ice.
Yep.
As recently as 18,000 years ago, which in geological terms, it's a little more than a blink of an eye. It's maybe three or four blinks of an eye, but that's all it is.
Yep.
What kind of climatological period are we in now? Very simple. We're in an interglacial period. We are between the last ice age, which ended around 11,000 years ago, and the next ice age, which, based on past patterns, is going to begin sometime between next week and the next 7,000 years. And,
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. And the real climate change that people should be worried about, those of us who are living now probably are not going to be concerned about it, but certainly those who come after us will be when the next ice age comes, because come it will. And all of this silly talk about carbon dioxide, man-made carbon dioxide emissions being a driver of climate is going to be seen for the gigantic hoax that it is when giant glaciers start forming again over the North Pole, as they have done in the past, and they start moving south, as they will, because it's almost inevitable that they will. So let's just keep that in context here. That's this is the Earth that we have. This is the planet that you hear people refer to all the time. But what they never do is they tell you the context.
Yep.
The last little ice age ended around 1850. It started in the Middle Ages, the latter part of the Middle Ages, lasted from about 1300 to 1850. Temperatures cooled a great deal. It was much cooler than it is now. Then for reasons, again, we don't understand, all of a sudden, the mid-19th century, things started warming up again. But it's interesting to look at the pattern at how they warmed up. There was a substantial warming that took place between 1850 and around 1940, but it wasn't a linear thing. It was zigzag, up, down, up, down, up, down. More up, however, than down. Then suddenly around 1940, things cooled off, and they cooled off considerably, all the way to around 1976, 1977. Remember, cover stories in two magazines that mercifully will be, one of them's already gone, and the other one I hope will be gone soon, Time and Newsweek, stated that we were headed for a new ice age because temperatures were so cold here.
And they were attributing that to human activity also, if you remember.
They were attributing that to human activities, which would have required regulations. Then, bingo, things started warming back up again, and they did indeed warm up, albeit not that much, but they warmed up. In other words, the warming we experienced between roughly 1977 and 1998 was simply a rebound from the cooling that we had experienced from 1940 to 1976, which itself was a rebounding from the warming that we had had before then. So you get the pattern here, up,
yes.
Down, up, down. The human contribution to this, well, the human beings had absolutely nothing to do with the ice ages that came on. For the most part, we weren't even here. We had nothing to do with their coming, and we had nothing to do with their going. I think it's hubris on the part of the ruling class in this country, or people who would like to aspire to the ruling class, by touting the human contribution to quote-unquote climate change, the notion that we're driving all of this, when there are forces in nature so much stronger than we will ever
but
be.
But isn't that consistent with the title that the leaders would like to have, Masters of the Universe?
Of course it is. Oh, yes.
I mean, you know, you can't underestimate my power.
Can't get the software for the introduction of the exchanges for Obamacare right. So if they can't get that right, do you
they,
really
they even
think
screwed
that,
up with Y2K? They predicted
yes,
that. Well,
that's
I think
right.
Chicken Little is working for these folks. But I've got to tell you something that's interesting. I was on my way to giving a speech at a political event. This is maybe 10 years ago. And I was in my car, and I was going crazy listening to what I was listening to. You know, I voted for Mayor Bloomberg the first two times, and then he said that it would be disgusting to run for a third term, and of course he did. He couldn't control himself. You want to talk about a guy out of control, it's Bloomberg. I think he's concerned that in another couple of months nobody will listen to him ever again. So he goes around. He doesn't want to pinch himself, so he pinches everybody else to make sure we're paying attention to him. So he issues these crazy proclamations. But they were talking about the need to turn down the thermostats in the winter and wear a sweater, turn off the
Jimmy
light.
Carter. Yep.
Jimmy Carter all over again.
Right.
But here's what's remarkable. He left the news conference, and his aides were there to finish the question and answer session because he had somewhere important to fly off in his private jet that spews how much? And someone
spews
said,
out, you know, God knows how many emissions, right? Yeah.
Right. And so someone said, you know, there's been an analysis that just his home, because he owns 19 houses and he has an airliner, he contributes a footprint, a carbon footprint, 19 times that of the average person.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the answer we got, I mean, this was wild. I got to tell you, I was in such a state of rage, it was hard to drive my car because I was screaming at the radio. With a straight face, apparently, but matter-of-fact voice, I couldn't see the face, but I could imagine the look. Well, the mayor understands that, but he does good work, so he's entitled.
That's right, yes. Yep, because, you know,
he's entitled.
In the right
and
place.
I thought, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That
entitled,
soldier
nice
that
word.
Just stepped on a landmine and lost both of his legs, saving the guys in his platoon, you know, I don't think that Bloomberg quite measures up.
No. As heroic
the special ed teachers who've dedicated themselves to teaching children with serious learning disabilities. I don't think Bloomberg measures up. The firefighters who race into, you want to talk about people doing good work? So do they get a pass
right.
also? Am I wrong on this, Bonner?
Oh, no, not at all. You could take the example from Mr. Bloomberg to Al Gore, who also lives in assorted palaces.
Yep.
To
do as I say, not as I do.
Not as I do. No, these people are jet setters. They have gamed the system and made Gore particularly has made an enormous amount of money in the alternative energy sector, which is heavily subsidized by American taxpayers, including the firefighters and the special ed teachers and all of that, who see their taxpayers' money funneled off to the well-connected so that their assorted alternative energy schemes, which couldn't stand alone without those subsidies, so that they're kept alive and so that the money flows, and we're talking about lots of money, continues to flow into the hands of the directors of those companies. So the level of hypocrisy here is absolutely breathtaking.
It is. And you know, again, I think we should do what we can to capture wind energy and tidal energy. And I have no problem with that. If we can do that, fine. But goodness, this business about shutting down industries that provide energy, it's one thing to say we're going to sequester the carbon and the pollution coming out of the plants that make electricity. I agree with it. Let's get the garbage out of the air. Everybody wants to breathe clean air. I have no argument with that. But to simply devastate industries on a broken hypothesis, on a false hypothesis, is crazy. You know, I think it's good to get off oil, especially Middle East. There's a lot of things we should do for a lot of reasons.
We in the United States don't need the silly Middle Eastern oil. We have plenty in this country. We're not only the Saudi Arabia of coal and the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. With Saudi Arabia of oil, we have more than anybody else has. And we have absolutely no business whatsoever denying ourselves access to our own very abundant natural resources.
And here's another thing that might be interesting. I have a theory that fossil fuels aren't only created by fossils.
You know what's interesting? Around the scientific community for some time, exactly.
Yes, because if you look at Titan, where we landed the space probe, one of Saturn's largest moons, actually the largest moon in the solar system, the Cassini probe sent off Huygens, the Huygens probe, which was an amazing feat of engineering, by the way. It has oceans of methane. So what we're seeing is organic chemicals being produced by obviously non-organic
mechanisms. That's exactly right. Yeah. So fossil fuels,
who's to
some
say,
of them really do come from fossil fuels, but what we call fossil fuels also have entirely different origins, and we have barely scratched the surface of that.
So my question is this. Is it unreasonable to, again, let's go back to ask the question. I'm not saying I have an answer, but it's a question no one asks. Is it possible that petroleum and hydrocarbons are being formed by non-biological processes under the deep pressures and temperatures to be found under the Earth's surface?
Oh, I think it's quite possible. And if you combine that with the fossil fuels, then you are talking about sources of energy which are, at least as far as we can see, completely inexhaustible. And
Why does no one ask these questions? Why is nobody willing to stand up and say, wait a minute, you have oceans of methane on Titan. There's no biology going on.
That's right.
It's an organic chemical. Could that not be happening? Why does no one even ask the question? See, this is my problem. We need to learn how to ask questions and get reasonable answers. Is that not what we should be doing?
That's exactly what we should be doing. Unfortunately, the way funds are dispensed here in Washington for research, if you are interested in something that goes against the grain of the prevailing wisdom in this town, you are not going to be funded. Research grants, sadly, have nothing to do with merit. In most cases, they are doled out on the basis of whether or not the premise on which your grant proposal is based is compatible with the preconceived notions of whatever agency you're applying to for your grant. So what you have is a research system in this country which, although it does do some very, very fine things, but it wastes an enormous amount of money funding things which are simply politically fashionable, and it denies that money to those people who think outside the box, who ask the questions that you rightly think should be asked, and who find themselves denied those research funds simply because their hypothesis is contrary to the prevailing wisdom of this town and will call into question a system which is frankly geared to serve those who are already in power.
So in other words, we're not only getting the best government money can buy, we're getting the best research papers that money can buy.
Yeah, right, exactly.
How does that work?
Yeah, it's not working very well.
It's working very well
for those who are the beneficiaries of this, and that's why it's so difficult to bring about change in Washington, simply because there are so many people on the take, and there are people in this town who are on the take who don't even know that they're on the take.
Because they don't know the source of the money that
because
they're
buying. They can't begin
follow
to
the
grasp
money.
The level of corruption that's around them.
Now, I'm glad you're joining me for the full program, but and I'm going to go a little bit past the top of the hour. And here's something that I want to get to, and I really want to thank you for going to this topic of global warming. Now, here's another disconnect that's making me nuts. Okay, the shooting at the Navy base by this piece of work, Aaron Alexis. We're hearing all the screaming and all the chest beating about what kind of background investigation did USIS do, the private company.
Right.
Which, by the way, is why I very often think certain things shouldn't be privatized, should be left to federal agencies. Law enforcement and the military, in my view, should not be privatized. When I was hired, the FBI did my background investigation. But now here's what's so remarkable. You have members of Congress jumping up and down, screaming about the failures to do background investigations. They look at Snowden and they say Edward Snowden's wackiness should have been picked up by his background investigation. Aaron Alexis should have been picked up by the background investigation. The Fort Hood massacre by Nadal Hassan.
What was his name? Yeah, I know who you're talking about. You're right. Yeah.
And so everybody jumped up and down about him and said, oh my God, why didn't they know what was going on with his background? If only they knew. How come they didn't realize it? And then you look at things. Here's something that appeared. This is on page 98 of the 9/11 Commission report. So this comes right off the 9/11 Commission report, which, by the way, should have been looked at, that report. And I'm proud to have been to have provided a statement for them. I did a deposition for the 9/11 Commission testimony. That was convened the way that the NTSB descends on a plane crash. You know, there's a smoking hole in the ground, and the NTSB shows up, and the FAA shows up, and the engineers from the airline companies and the manufacturers show up. For two reasons. One is to assign blame, which keeps the lawyers happy. But more importantly, to figure out what went wrong to avoid making more holes in the ground, to save lives. So it was with that in mind that they convened the 9/11 Commission. So everyone said, well, first of all, illegal aliens should go into the military so they could prove that they're on our side, and then we can give them citizenship. Now, page 68 of the 9/11 report. You're going to love this one. Pardon me. As early as December 1993, a team of Al-Qaeda operatives had begun casing targets in Nairobi, Kenya for future attacks. This is where they bombed the embassy. It was led by Ali Mohammed, a former Egyptian army officer who had moved to the United States in the mid-1980s, enlisted in the U.S. Army, and became an instructor at Fort Bragg. He had provided guidance and training to extremists at the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn, including some who were subsequently convicted in the February 93 attack at the World Trade Center. We're putting people in the military, giving them tactical training and weapons so they can go ahead and then use it against us. We saw that with the Mexican Zetas. These were members of the military and law enforcement in Mexico, the best of the best. They're now the most violent of all the drug cartels. We trained and armed them. So now you've got this deal going with my God, why didn't they do a better background investigation on Aaron Alexis and on Edward Snowden? And here's the point. Do you know that right now the Dreamers, these aliens who are getting lawful status purportedly because they're kids, by the way, the age cutoff is 31. I'm on the wrong side of 60. 31 sounds young, but I don't know of any society where a 31-year-old is called a child. But if you look at the profile, there's that ugly word, profile, of terrorists, they tend to be under the age of 30. So
right.
We have given hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens whose true date of entry and true identities are really known only to them. We're giving them identity backgrounds, and we're not even doing a face-to-face interview. Now,
no,
think of how
amazing.
Astonishing that is.
Yeah.
And so you have a member of the Senate saying, what's most frightening is that USIS performs a majority of background checks for our government. We clearly need a top-to-bottom overhaul on how we vet those who have access to our secrets and secure facilities. Well, wait a moment. The president said something very similar. How about the people who have access to our country whose presence here represents a violation of our borders and laws that are there to do two primary things, protect American lives and American jobs? So the disconnect and the hypocrisy is never ending. On the one hand, they scream bloody murder about the way that background checks are done on people who have gun permits and people who have security clearances. But on the other hand, no one's paying attention to the fact that if we had to have a massive amnesty program, they wouldn't even be able to do more than run a name or fingerprints through a computer, period.
Yeah, very good point.
Now, look at that monumental disconnect, and then look at how the 9/11 Commission said that immigration fraud was one of the most significant embedding tactics of the terrorists. In fact, the 9/11 Commission was able to identify 94 terrorists who, in the decade leading up to 9/11, entered the United States and embedded themselves. Of the 94, 59, or about two-thirds of them, used visa fraud and benefit fraud. And you know what, Bonner? On May 20th, 1997, I testified before my first congressional hearing on the issue of visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud. So 4.5 years before 9/11, the government knew that the way that we issued visas and the way that we processed applications for immigration benefits was enabling terrorists to enter the United States and embed themselves. Guess what
right.
we've done about it? Nothing.
Zero. Nothing. Yeah.
Zipperoonie. And so here we are, 12 years after 9/11, and I would remind you, it only took us 44 months to win the Second World War. It required building airplanes that had never existed, ships, weapon systems, atom bombs, you name it. We did it 44 months. Here we are 12 years after 9/11 and almost 21 years since the attacks of 93. And guess what? None of those vulnerabilities have been addressed. And in fact, they've made it worse because on 9/11, we had 26 countries that subscribed to the visa waiver program. Today, 37 countries are on that list. So you look at this and you really want to ask these idiots, whose side are you on? What's the end game? If you're the pilot of this airplane, where's our destination? Where do you plan for us to touch down? How's that for a question if we're going to ask questions?
Oh, yeah. It's a very profound question because we know where this will lead. It will lead in one form or another. We don't know when. We don't know where. But it will lead to the next terrorist attack in this country because it's almost programmed by a
yep.
system, which is this incompetent, a system who run by people who are purposely not asking the question that you just asked. First of all, they're not paid to do that. And secondly, that would be completely contrary to how all of these things operate. We must be politically correct, not step on certain toes, not even use the word illegal alien, the term illegal alien, but talk
yeah,
about
was,
undocumented.
Do you know there was a lawyer that just got suspended in Indiana for using the term illegal alien?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And you have universities. UCLA now said that the word illegal constitutes hate speech. So, interesting
story. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
The day after Labor Day, I was in the shower, had the radio on to find out the weather and the traffic and all that other good stuff, and they were talking about how a bunch of swimmers went to a beach, either out on Long Island or New Jersey, somewhere or other, and there were big signs posted that the lifeguards were no longer on duty, that summer was over, swimming was prohibited. The police came in, and, you know, they didn't arrest anybody, but they ejected them from the beach. The newscaster who reported on the story described the swimmers as being illegal swimmers. I assure you, he would not have referred to illegal aliens. It's just like Bloomberg.
No.
And Bloomberg jumps up and down talking about trespassers in public housing and says, people in those houses want the cops to stop the people wandering around and ask them, who are you, why are you here? Okay, which is reasonable. But when you talk about trespassing on America, then Bloomberg wants
to give them the keys
to the city.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you look at this, you look at the disconnect, and then you say to yourself, wait a minute, these guys are not made of steel. If there's another terrorist attack, if they or their families are in the wrong place on the wrong day, they could be obliterated. What in the world does it take to wake people up that they are playing with the potential for their own destruction? I had a major argument with Michael Chertoff about this. We were both at Chapman Law School, and eventually he agreed with me that immigration was a major factor in 9/11, but I will tell you that for 20 minutes he did everything in his power to convince me I was wrong and then had a reverse direction. And, you know, when I asked him a question at the luncheon the next day at Chapman Law School, he said something that on one hand flattered me, on the other hand scared the hell out of me. He told me that I understood immigration better than anybody who had worked for him when he was Secretary of Homeland Security. So as I say, on the one hand, I was very flattered.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it scared the hell out of me.
Right.
So this is where we are. This is the state of affairs that we find ourselves in. And folks, you really need to learn to ask the questions. You know, when I was talking to Bonner earlier today, we did a little pre-interview on the phone. You know, we got into this discussion about the space program, one of my favorite areas, a program that has all but ended under this great stewardship of this president. Boy, if you want to talk about a human waffle, it's this president. You know, talk about follow the yellow brick road, try to follow the red line. But the biggest return we've gotten from the space program is the next set of questions. JFK had once very intelligently remarked that you judge a person's intelligence by the questions they ask. If you don't ask the questions, you don't get the answers, and nothing will change. It's incumbent on all of us to do our homework and then confront the politicians peacefully, you know, peaceful assemblage to the First Amendment, but let them understand that we're not as stupid as they hope we are. Is that not a reasonable perspective to have?
Well, it certainly is, absolutely.
And when was the last time you saw anybody really asking the hard questions? You know, I could be wrong about the geological processes that may or may not be producing organic chemicals, but why is no one asking that question? And is that not at least a reasonable question?
Well, it certainly is. And of course, one of the reasons it's, you know, the questions probably are here, there, and yonder being asked, but they're not being asked where they should be asked. They're not being asked in public, except, you know, perhaps
and they're
on,
not being
on the
reported
radio
on.
Show. Yeah, exactly. They will not be reported on, and they will most certainly not be acted on.
Right.
Until it's too late.
Just absolutely astonishing. I mean, I think this is probably a safe thing to say that we are living under the most corrupt American government that we've probably ever had to suffer under.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree with that completely.
I think that the likes of Dwight Eisenhower and JFK and Harry Truman and all those great leaders must be pinwheeling in their graves tonight.
I'm sure they are.
If we could harness that energy, that would be something, wouldn't it?
Well,
anyway, Bonner, I want to tell you what a delight it was to have you on the program this evening.
Well, I certainly enjoyed being here.
And we will have to have you come back and continue our conversation. But I really think that at the root of the conversation, folks, has to be the questioning of authority, the questioning of what are paraded as facts. Don't take anything at face value. The Discover Channel has a wonderful two-word slogan that we should all adopt, and it's very simply, question everything.
Yeah. Very, very sound advice.
Well, hopefully my listeners will listen and heed the advice and call their members of Congress and not only complain but ask the questions. And you know what really gets them? It's the well-thought-out follow-up question. It's the one-two
right.
punch.
Exactly.
I used to do a little boxing as a kid, and it was always two lefts and a right, those two little jabs,
yeah, right.
soften the target up, and it was that right cross that finished them off.
That
right cross
exactly.
is the well-placed follow-up question, to use an analogy. But we've got to come up with the questions, folks, because in those questions, we will raise the doubt of the people that we're speaking with, and we will demonstrate our depth, breadth, and force of knowledge. And that's the best antidote to the corruption and the stupidity that seems to be flowing without impediment from Washington and from state capitals across America and from city halls across America and all too often on university campuses. I've often compared university campuses to the parade grounds of military bases. On the military base, on the parade grounds, the soldiers march lockstep. It would seem that the same thing is now happening in academia as well.
It certainly is, and it's not only happening in academia. They charge you enormous gobs of money to have your child learn how to march in lockstep. So, and when the poor kid gets out, he still doesn't have a job.
This is really astonishing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the end of the day, I always think of the sage advice my dad gave me when he said that I would teach people ultimately how they should treat me, by demonstrating what I was willing to accept. And as they say in that movie by the Movie Network written by Patty Chayefsky, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And the way to demonstrate it, folks, is to reach out to your elected representative. Democracy is not a spectator sport. And make certain that they come away, the politicians come away, with the understanding that we really aren't as dumb as they were hoping we were.
That is exactly right.
Well, on that note, Bonner, I will wish you a great weekend, and thank you again for being on the program. And for my listeners, just hang in there for a minute or two. I just want to, again, give you a little bit of information. I want to remind you to please go to my website, michaelcutler.net. Please go to capsweb.org. Congress is in session. They're going to do all sorts of mischief. Remember that the politicians are supposed to work for us. If we're good employers, then we're giving our employees clear marching orders. We need to do that. I ask that you call your congressman next week, write that letter, send that piece of snail mail, although that takes an awfully long time given the rigmarole they have to go through because of concerns about all kinds of stuff being mailed to Congress. So probably the smartest thing is a fax or a phone call or an email. And please try to meet with your congressional representatives in the district office as well. Any way that you could reach out and contact these folks to make certain that they live up to their responsibility to represent you. They can't represent you if they don't hear from you. That's why I always like to say that democracy is not a spectator sport. I look forward to seeing all of you next week at the same time on the Michael Cutler Hour. Meanwhile, I wish all of you a great weekend, and thanks for listening. See you next week, folks.